The Fan on Demand.
Analysis and opinion so honest, it's just a matter of time before they get themselves in trouble. Baseball Central on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
One game over 500 is where the Blue Jays find themselves after last night's 4-3 loss to the Boston Red Sox. Hello, everybody. This is Baseball Central, brought to you by Home Hardware. Jeff Blair alongside Joe Siddle of our Blue Jays broadcast crew. The Jays down 3-0 to Clay Buchholz last night. Tied it up, forced extra innings. Just missed. Edwin Encarnacion just missed. Just missed winning it. In the 10th inning, Aaron Sanchez came on to pitch for the Blue Jays and stolen base. And, a 1-2 curve to Yonas Cespedes that Cespedes, not a great swing, Cespedes drew a hit to deliver the winning run. And, Joe, I'm watching that and I'm thinking to myself, all right, here we go again, because one of the things we've talked about is Deonner Navarro sometimes not going with the guy's number one pitch, his best pitch in that situation, clearly a fastball. But you brought up right away on the broadcast, you made a point as a former catcher, you understand what Navarro was thinking, you understand why Sanchez went along with it, and we saw both of their reactions. Navarro picked up a handful of dirt and threw it in the ground, and Sanchez kind of swiped at the mound. And I want you to walk us through that, because you made a point right away that in that situation, it may have been more a matter of poor execution than poor pitch selection on the part of the catcher and pitcher.
Yeah, well, Deonner Navarro has been criticized a little bit this year, earlier in the year, I think more so about calling the breaking ball a little bit more than most people would. But I think in this situation last night, you've got a young pitcher in Aaron Sanchez, and I think Deonner might be looking a pitch or two ahead, and that's what you have to do as a catcher. What's your plan of attack to get Cespedes in this situation? I think the fastball was overpowering, and that's a very valid argument. What Deonner's plan was, I think, was to bounce that curveball, see if Cespedes would chase, because he does chase. But then if he misses with it, then you come back with the fastball, and that's how you're probably going to get him out. What happened here is Aaron Sanchez just left that ball right out over the plate, and as a young pitcher, veteran pitcher, it doesn't matter. If you do not execute your pitch, it's hard to execute that game plan. So in defense of Deonner Navarro, it's easy to say after something happens, again, this is a results-oriented business. It did not go the Jays' way, so the critics will be out. But Aaron Sanchez did not execute his pitch, and I'm sure he'll be the first one to say that.
And, you know, it's funny because I talked to Aaron a little bit on Sunday, Joe, and we talked about the whole, the transition, if you want, into the bullpen. And I think one of the things Aaron was thinking is you know, when you're a reliever, you come out of the bullpen, you're probably going to rely more than anything else on your fastball. And he admitted, look, I'm not, as he said, shame on any pitcher who just loses their stuff because they're in the bullpen. But he said, you know, I'm trying to figure out what I have to do to maintain some of my other stuff, because, yeah, you like to say that I'll throw any pitch anytime for a strike. But the fact of the matter is, quite often as a reliever, you're going to rely on your fastball.
And right now, as a catcher, you have to know too that Sanchez does not quite have that feel for the curveball. He's got three great pitches, but it's been a little different coming out of the bullpen. And Aaron also said it's very interesting that since he's made this transition to the bullpen, it's very difficult to work on your pitches a whole lot. When you're a starter, you throw your game, you've got 4 days, you've got your side session to work on all that stuff. And you know what? That playing catch, that flat ground, it's so different. And he was first to say that too, than being on the mound. But as a reliever, he has difficulty really finding that time to work too much on that curveball if he doesn't have the feel for it, because you don't want to throw 20 curveballs in the afternoon. You may have to pitch tonight. So it's a delicate situation, a transition that he's still learning. But bottom line, too, as a catcher, getting back to Navarro, you have to know that. You have to also know that Sanchez does not quite have the feel for the curveball right now. So do you just stay fastballs? Well, if he throws another fastball there, tries to elevate it or get it away, and he misses down the plate and Cespedes hits a base hit, we're all saying, why don't you mix in a curveball? So, again, it's results-oriented. Bottom line is, pitcher has to execute whatever pitch that's put down.
It's Jeff Blair and Joe Siddle in Baseball Central. And that's kind of my point. There are times when you can sit there and criticize the catcher for pitch selection, or you can criticize the pitcher for not shaking him off. But sometimes, even if it wasn't, if you put 10 people in the room, 8 would probably say fastball is your first option. 2 would probably say, I kind of see what Deonner Navarro is doing. This to me is one of those instances where the blame, if you want to call it that, has to be tempered because there was a thought behind it. There was a thought behind it.
And my rule of thumb as a catcher is in tight situations like this late in a ball game, you have to win or lose with your best pitch. Unfortunately, Aaron Sanchez lost with his second best pitch last night. Now, he didn't execute it, of course, but that's why right now it's his second best pitch. Mm-hmm. That, to me, as a catcher, I'd have a tough time going to bed last night. That would rile me the rest of the night. And when you watch that base hit by Cespedes, the first thing I noticed was Deonner Navarro picked up some dirt and fired it in the ground. He was very upset. Catchers take a lot of pride in the way they call a ball game, and when it does not go right, it's not a lot of fun. But that's a situation, again, where hindsight's 20-20, mm-hmm. but if you do come back, all the people that wanted a fastball there and away or up to get Cespedes to chase, if he missed with his fastball right there, less likely because it is his number one pitch and it's a more controllable pitch. But it does happen. Pitchers miss in the middle of the play with their fastballs too, and Cespedes gets a base hit. The critics are going the other way.
You want to point out something else as well. And again, you mentioned this in the broadcast last night. The stolen base off Aaron Sanchez, the steal of second by Brock Holt. I mean, Dustin Pedroia essentially falls across the mound. Across the plate. And you can see Navarro take that into account when he throws the ball. And you made the point in that situation, you've got to go ahead and air it out. And you got a tailor-made case for interference that play.
It's easier said than done, but as a catcher, it's human nature to avoid the hitter. Dustin Pedroia swung at strike three, fell across home plate. Now, as a catcher, if you're throwing the ball to second base and your hand touches the batter, mm-hmm. it'll be interference. But as a catcher, for some reason, human nature is to avoid that batter and try to make that throw. But you can see that Deonner Navarro, I think he held up his throw. I think when he was throwing the baseball, he stopped his arm and held up. Therefore, the throw came in short, and that's what provided the short hop down there for Kawasaki. But as a catcher, you want to, at a very young age, I was trained in the minor leagues, that when you do that, even if you do kind of forget, just fall forward and fall on him. Make it look silly. But bottom line is you have to make contact with that batter. Now, in saying that, I think the problem here again was a 21-year-old pitcher on the mm-hmm. mound who forgot about Brock Holt a little bit. And if Brock Holt gets a great jump, no catcher's going to throw him out anyway. It's going to be very difficult. But that's a growing pain right there for Aaron Sanchez. And those are things that you have to learn as a pitcher. It's not just about throwing 98 curveball changeup and throwing great pitches. Everybody thinks that's a great pitcher. There's a lot of other things that go into it. Holding runners, fielding your position, all those things.
And then Brock Holt steals third, although as you point out, that he's probably going to score on that hit anyhow, considering it's Colby going for the ball.
Yeah, he took off for third. He had it stolen easily. Aaron, again, caught not really paying attention to him, but I'm not as big a fan. Philippe Alou was big on that in Montreal. Sometimes as a catcher, he would just put his hand over his mouth and tell us to eat it if he steals third, because he does not want the third baseman vacating his position right there for a right-handed hitting Cespedes. He would give him third base.
Yeah.
Some people may disagree with that, but my point is, I think on that base hit, I don't think Colby Rasmus is throwing Brock Holt out at the plate anyway because he was already in scoring position. The big play for me was Holt stealing second base.
Yeah, and Felipe was right about that. You don't want... at some point, you have to think about your defensive positioning first and limiting the damage. And in that particular instance, that was the case. Although, it is true. And again, Aaron Sanchez admitted this. Hey, there are things that when you're in the game in relief, there's a different aspect to it. You don't, this is wording he said, I can't throw a get me over breaking pitch as a reliever. There's no get me over, right?
It's nice to have that good of stuff.
I was going to say, yeah, your get me over curve is most people's first pitch. But I don't know what Aaron Sanchez, what's going to happen with him in this organization. He's going to be on the major league roster next year. Depending on what happens in the offseason, depending on what deals are made, I think it could be as a starter. But it wouldn't surprise me if at some point you see him in the bullpen as well. Just depends on how things shake out.
Yeah, he's got three quality pitches, though. I think that's got starting rotation written all over it.
Yeah, and as John Gibbons said, what would you rather have, 45 innings of that arm or 145 innings of that arm? It's Baseball Central on Sportsnet 590, the Fan, the Sportsnet Television Network. Brought to you by Home Hardware. FP Santangelo, by the way, good friend of ours, the color analyst with the Washington Nationals. He will join us at 12:40. The Nationals are the best team in baseball right now. The numbers back it up. They lost 3-2 last night to A.J. Burnett and the Phillies. But my goodness, on just about every statistical level, the Washington Nationals are the best team in baseball. And Ryan Zimmerman's returning. Matt Williams, their manager, has got an interesting decision to make at some point. with his roster. Some other news as far as the Blue Jays are concerned. You heard in Andrew Nye's update, Kevin Pillar has been recalled from AAA Buffalo. Nolan Reimold has been designated for assignment. Joe Kevin Pillar, of course, sent down to Buffalo after his dugout blow up, if you want to call it that. A lot of people have thought that he should be up a lot sooner than this. In fact, a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, have kind of accused John Gibbons of holding some sort of a grudge against Kevin Pillar. I've been on the record. This is a move that I think should have been made earlier. I'd rather have Kevin Pillar, Anthony Gose, and Ryan Goins up here right now, because I just think that you're a better team with those three guys.
I agree 100%, and I don't know what went into that decision with Kevin Pillar going down, but to me, you've got some young kids here. There's one way to find out if they can compete at this level. And, I mean, there's been some experiments going on with Reimhold, Cole Gillespie, these guys picked up off the waiver wire, and you give these guys opportunities. But I'm the same way, Jeff. I think Ryan Goins is such a good second baseman, and this is my first year seeing him. I know you guys have seen them more than just this year, but he has been so impressive at second base. And defensively, I will take him in my lineup every day of the week. I don't even care if he gets a hit. And I was critical of him early in the season because the offense was not there. Said it's time to go back down and figure that swing out. He came back up and did a nice job, but then he had his struggles again. But you know what? The more I look at him, I don't care if he's hitting 200. Put him at second base, and he does such a good job defensively that I think what we do is sometimes we undervalue defense and how much defense can help a pitcher.
Jays, by the way, will send R.A. Dickey to the mound tonight against Ruby De La Rosa and the Red Sox. What do you think, Joe, is the best case scenario for Kevin Pillar with the Blue Jays? I mean, I look at him and Anthony Gose, and yeah, they're both young, but something I honestly don't see everyday players in those two guys. I see guys who are right now bench players. Gose maybe at some point figures it out to the point where he can be an everyday player. But I look at both of those guys as bench players.
I do right now, but I think you do also have to give young guys a chance to develop and improve. These are young kids still, and this game is very difficult at the major league level. I don't care what numbers guys put up in AAA, because we've seen countless times in different organizations as well. Great numbers in AAA, guys get to the big leagues and they're very marginal players. It's a different league up here. And I think we have to really reiterate how difficult it is to be an everyday major league baseball player. Mm-hmm. At any position, because those guys have to hit. And when you're out there every day, opposing teams are attacking your weaknesses. We talk about the video and technology out there. There's scattering reports. It's very difficult. I don't think anybody here is going to. You can throw Anthony Gose and Kevin Pillar in the everyday lineup all of next year. That's still not necessarily going to answer the question. I think it takes a year or two in the big leagues to really solidify, can this guy compete on an everyday basis?
Joe, Clay Buchholz pitched 8 1/3 innings last night, 4 hits, 3 earned runs, 2 walks, 4 Ks. The best we've seen Clay Buchholz in a long time. What was the difference in the Clay Buchholz you saw last night compared to the Clay Buchholz we've seen earlier this year? And how much of that was Clay Buchholz, and how much of it was just the fact that the Jays right now aren't swinging the bats with particular authority?
I think number one key is that there's nothing like a pitcher catching a team at a bad time. And right now, Clay Buchholz caught the Blue Jays hitters at the right time. But Clay Buchholz is very good last night. Give him credit. He threw his 5 pitches. I talked at the open of the broadcast. Sometimes pitchers have 5 pitches, fastball, curveball, slider, changeup, and the cutter. And you may think it's very difficult to command 5 pitches, be good at throwing 5 pitches. But he was very good last night, and he threw all 5. So what a combination. And again, when you're on, you know, wouldn't it be the Jays' luck that here's a guy that's really had his struggles this year, and it all comes together.
And Jay Happ got the no decision, 6 innings pitch, 5 hits, 3 earned runs, 8 Ks, 2 walks, really one tough inning. And in fact, Melky Cabrera saved him a little bit with that throw as well. What do you think of Jay Happ in his recent starts?
I think he was very good. I talked about it last night. His last start in Milwaukee, I think it was just a bad mismatch for Jay Happ. Mm-hmm. He's a fastball-throwing guy, and he's facing a Milwaukee Brewers team that goes up hacking. They are looking for the fastball, and they're hacking. So I think I said they jumped him. Well, basically, I think it was the first inning there where they hit a few doubles and scored a couple runs. And before anybody could make an adjustment, I saw Deion Navarro go out to the mound. And as a catcher, that's what you say. Hey, we got to go to plan B here. These guys are on the attack. So he just got jumped and it didn't go so well in Milwaukee. But last night, I thought he was very good. He was all around the plate again. I mean, Mookie Betts hits a 3-2 fastball out of the ballpark. What are you going to do? What do you, you're not going to throw a curveball 3-2 to a guy hitting down the bottom batting order like that. And he hit it out of the ballpark. And then with Dustin Pedroia, 0-0 curveball, first pitch curveball. He's just trying to get a curveball over to a pretty decent hitter, and he jumped on it. I have no problem with Jay Happ last night. I thought he did a very fine job, and I think what he's been doing in general has been very good. We've talked about him and his fastball. To me, it's his biggest pitch. He's got such a good arm, but I do believe that delivery provides some deception as well because, again, we saw it last night, and I commented on it, that when he throws his fastball, hitters don't seem to be on it. Now, the Milwaukee Brewers were, mind you, but most hitters just don't seem to be on it. They seem to be a little tardy all the time.
Yeah, and I know you pointed out very early, there is a deception there when you watch the way the ball comes out of his hand. It's actually, if you watch it on TV, if you have the one camera angle for behind home plate, it's hard to see when the ball actually leaves his fingers.
I think it's his stature. He's a tall guy. He's a big guy. And the way that arm comes around. And now you're talking on a TV monitor. Now put yourself in that batter's box. It's very difficult to pick up the baseball. But again, I watch the swings of hitters. And as a catcher, that's what you have to do is read the swings of hitters. And for most of this season in general, I have not seen a ton of great swings off J-Hop's fastball. Now, I'm not saying he throws off fastballs, but he does throw up to 70% when he's pretty good. But he'll mix in that curveball and changeup. He's kind of aborted the slider a little bit this year, which is a fine thing. He's gone predominantly with the curveball and changeup. But when he mixes those off-speed pitches in, makes that fastball even better.
Joe, as a former catcher, what's your opinion of Christian Vasquez? He's a guy who's getting a lot of play in Boston. We know, obviously, that one of the moves the Red Sox made in the offseason was getting rid of Jared Saltalamacchi. A catcher hasn't been much of a concern for that organization for the longest time. It was Jason Veritek. But what do you think of Vasquez?
I really like him. And early when we saw him at Fenway Park, it was the first time I met him. And I went over and talked to him, just said, I like the way you handle yourself behind the plate. But I saw a lot of things last night, very veteran-like for a young kid. And he took a lot of pride in what he was doing behind the plate. And that's what you have to do as a catcher. You need a defensive guy back there handling the ballgame. And I thought he did a great job with Buchholz. But here's a guy with a great arm, too. He's not afraid to throw the baseball. You saw him fire down to the bases yesterday a little bit, and I made that comment, too. I'd love to see that out of any catcher, but especially a young kid that's not intimidated, not afraid to show that arm. You got a great arm. Show it off and use it. He's been very successful throwing runners out stealing. But when you start doing what he did, firing down to first base, I think it was Valencia the one time, you may not get runners, but you're making a statement so that everybody in that Blue Jays dugout knows that when they're on base, whatever base it is, first or second or third, you can't get quite as much now with that secondary lead. You better be careful. And a lot of times, that's the difference if it's second base or first base, going first to home, scoring a run. And a lot of times, the difference at home plate, that play at the plate is fractions of seconds. It could be just that little bit of knowledge that they have in their head, and that's from him using his arm and showing it off.
And it's been a rough year for the Red Sox pitchers and for their catchers as well. They've had a lot of different pitchers. They've had injuries. It's really a team in transition, and you know, if you talk to people who cover the team, they'll tell you that probably the area that has been the greatest concern has been the starting pitching. So you have that combination of a guy trying to make his mark as a catcher, and you're working with new pitchers and guys who are in their own way sort of trying to make their mark. That's putting a lot in some young shoulders. It really is.
I think the A.J. Pierzynski experiment just went bad. Right. It really went sour. It didn't work out for the Red Sox. It turned out to be a horrible move on their part. And I think you kind of look back now, and you've got the veteran David Ross, but you probably missed that Saltalamacchia factor a little bit more than perhaps they anticipated.
Yeah, I can remember when the Red Sox made their moves in the offseason, talking to Rob Bradford of WEEI, and he was making the point that He thought people were just horribly, horribly underestimating the importance of Jacoby Ellsbury and Saltalamacchia. You know, he said that he thought there was this idea that somehow Saltalamacchia was really kind of a disposable guy. And he said the guy wasn't. The guy was a very good player for them last year. And the Red Sox have been lucky throughout their recent history. They've had that guy in Veritek who was almost like an extension of Terry Francona when he was there. He was almost like having an extra pitching coach. And I really think that the Red Sox may have miscalculated his importance.
I think especially, and that's a key position, we talk about being strong up the middle, and we talk about that in baseball because it is very important to be strong up the middle. Catcher, second and short, and center field. But Ellsbury to me is a huge one. That's a 300 hitter that steals 50 something bases, and that's a big knock when they were not able to bring him back. But again, when you look back at that magical ride that the Red Sox had, and I think some of them will refer to it to just that. When you win a World Series, a lot of things have to go right. Napoli had a tremendous year, 20 plus homers, almost 100 ribbies. Look at the J.D. Drew or Stephen Drew's contribution.
Right.
Middlebrooks had like 17 home runs. The list goes on and on. It was just a real special year. Victorino was very good. Daniel Nava hit 300, mm-hmm. hit 12 home runs. So, I mean, a lot of contributions. And as I said, it was a magical ride. And that's what happens when you win a World Series. A lot of special things happen. And I think that's the way it was in Boston. And unfortunately for the Red Sox, they've just taken a 180 this year.
A little bit of news, sort of Blue Jays related yesterday, kind of caught our attention. You remember probably the name Phil Bickford. He was the 10th pick overall in the 2013 draft by the Blue Jays. Now, depending on who you believe or who you talk to, the thinking is that he turned down something in the neighborhood of $2.2 million from the Blue Jays in order to go to Cal State Fullerton. And lo and behold, he has a terrific season in the Cape Cod League, terrific summer in the Cape Cod League. He has now apparently decided to leave Cal State Fullerton. And the thinking now is he will either, well, he'll definitely go into the draft next year, but the thinking is he will either go to independent baseball or go to Cypress Community College, a junior college where he would be reunited with Scott Parker, who was his coach this year in Cape Cod. He's 20 years old in July. He was dominant in the Cape Cod League. And I know when the Jays drafted him at the time, it was a risky pick because most people thought that he was going to end up going to Cal State Fullerton. We're going to be joined by Aaron Fitt of Baseball America in just a second. But, Aaron's there already? Great. Aaron, come on in. How are you, Aaron?
Hey, guys. I'm doing all right. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You're on with Jeff Blair and Joe Siddle. How much of a surprise is this?
Well, it's very surprising. You know, I mean, you seldom see a marquee guy who chooses the college route to transfer or leave his program after a freshman year. I mean, you know, it's almost surprising it doesn't happen more often because there are plenty of players that, you know, have a great freshman year and maybe could have a chance to maximize their draft stock by being eligible a year earlier, but it just does not usually happen. And, you know, even when we've heard rumors of it happening in the past, it seems like it doesn't usually wind up working and the player just decides to stay where he is. And a lot of times these players make a commitment to their teams, you know, and that's one thing about this story that does not reflect well on Bickford is, you know, he didn't tell his coach about this decision to leave until this past weekend. You know, and class starts today. So This guy's on a full scholarship, and they can't give his money to get a new player to replace him. They're basically stuck eating his scholarship. So really, he didn't do a very good job being considerate of his teammates.
Well, and this people should know too. Cal State Fullerton. This is one of the the Rolls Royces of college baseball programs, isn't it? They in fact would have been a favorite for to be a College World Series contender this year.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, this is a storied program. They won four national championships, and they've got a really good pitching staff coming back and an elite staff. I think they really had a chance to win a national championship, and you know you would want that to be something that I think is important to a player. You know, I mean, we want guys that want to win, right? So the fact that he's willing to walk away from that, especially 3 days before the season starts or before the school starts, I should say. I don't know. I mean, I think you have to question his competitiveness a little bit.
Aaron, was this? Would you consider this almost a flaw in the system? I mean, it seems very unfair on a lot of counts.
Yeah, it is, and I wonder if you know if this works out for Bickford, if we'll see more players try to do this because, you know, the way that the rules work is once you set foot on a Division I campus, of course, you're not draft eligible again for 3 years, and you can't transfer freely to another Division I school without having to sit out a year. So most of the time we don't see a lot of player movement. But the exception is there's not a lot of rules in the junior college ranks. You know, you can go play junior college ball and, you know, you don't have to sit out a year. You can play right away and you can, you know, be eligible for the draft that year. So there's reason to do it, but I think that the guys that do it, I just think it shows you a lot about their character. I mean, these are guys that they're in it for themselves. They want to maximize their own value. And hey, you know, all these players have to look out for their own best interests. I mean, I don't think we can begrudge a player for doing what's best for himself, but there's a way to do it. And I don't think Bickford did it the right way.
Aaron Fitt of Baseball America joins us on Baseball Central. Did we ever figure out what happened with Bickford and the Blue Jays? I mean, it was going to be a bit of a gamble to begin with, wasn't it? But was there some concern about the medicals, or how did this thing break down?
You know, that the details about that are still pretty murky, and you know, we heard some talk, some speculation from people around the situation that maybe the Blue Jays were concerned about the medical, but we really don't know. I mean, surprisingly, that's one of those things that they've done a pretty good job keeping a lid on. You know, I mean, it seems like the Astros situation this year with their number one pick, Brady Aiken, everybody knows all the details. You know, he had his concerns about the elbow, and you know, there's the irregularities. We knew all this stuff. The Blue Jays, to their credit, I think, did not spill the beans here to the media, which very seldom do we see that happen. I don't know. I mean, but I know that Bickford came back and pitched and was healthy all year, and he was sitting 93-95 in the Cape this summer and touched some 97s, I heard. You know, his arm works. He's not hurt. So maybe the Blue Jays were concerned about something, but whether that concern was justified, I have no idea.
Aaron, can you let our listeners know what's the process there with a team about to sign a first-round pick? Can an agreement maybe made? Can it be made verbally before the selection?
That's discouraged, but it happens all the time. I mean, technically, it's against the rules. If you agree with a team before the draft, you're breaking Major League Baseball rules. But you know, it's one of those things that's ignored by everybody, especially with the draft system the way it is now, where, you know, you really have to know if a player's going to sign before you risk a pick on him, because if one of your top 10 round picks does not sign, you lose the ability to spend the money that was allotted to his pick. You know, it just comes out of your pool. You can't spend it on another player. So these teams have to have certainty when they draft the guy, which is why the vast majority of players in the top 10 round do sign, is because there's already been really an agreement before the draft has even happened.
Aaron, if Phil Bickford decides to go the independent ball route compared to the junior college, I'd like your take on where you think he goes, or whether he goes JC or goes independent ball. Do you have any idea what league he would end up in?
Well, I think he's going to take the junior college route, and you know, that's to be determined.
Do you think it'd be with Scott Pickler, the guy who coached him in the Cape League?
That's certainly possible. I've heard some people out west talk about that rumor, and it makes sense. I mean, Scott Pickler is very well respected, and Cypress Junior College has a good history. But, you know, I don't know. There's other places he could go. He might want to stay a little bit closer to home and go to Oxnard Junior College, which is a little bit north of L.A., close to where he grew up. Or he might go out of state. I've heard people say that, too. So, really, we don't know yet. But my gut says he'll probably take the junior college route.
Aaron, it was good of you to do this. Thanks so much.
All right, guys. My pleasure.
Take care. That is Aaron Fitt of Baseball America. Again, Phil Bickford, who was picked 10th in the 2013 draft by the Blue Jays, did not sign, turned down an offer reported to be around $2 million, went to Cal State Fullerton, has now told that school that he will not be returning for this year. He will not be returning for his sophomore year. He will, in fact, either play independent baseball or, as Aaron Fitt of Baseball America just told us, more than likely go to junior college, possibly Cypress Junior College, where he would play for Scott Bickler, who coached him in the Cape Cod Summer League. And either way, Phil Bickford will be going back into the draft next year. And it will be interesting to see, Joe, where he goes. It's if you take a look at the early draft projections, he is given a chance to be certainly a top four pick. Some people will say right now that he has a chance to be the number one pick.
Well, and as Aaron alluded to, I think this is just a young player that knows there's lots of money to be made, and it's a very selfish decision. But at the same time, I know you'll talk a lot to pro athletes, and there's a small window to play this game and to make some money, and he's trying to take advantage of that right now.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, 10th overall, going number one, this going number one, number two, number three, that's about the only way you're going to make more money than being the 10th overall pick. The Washington Nationals, I think we can call them the best team in Major League Baseball. I think we're on pretty safe ground doing that. They have been on an unconscious roll lately, lost last night to A.J. Burnett in the Philadelphia Phillies. F.P. Santangelo, a former teammate of Joe Siddall, a friend of this show, is the Washington Nationals color analyst. And F.P. Santangelo will join us when Baseball Central continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now, back to more Baseball Central on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to Baseball Central. I've been really looking forward to this part of it. Not that I wasn't looking forward to the other part, Joe Siddall, but we are reaching out to F.P. Santangelo, the color analyst for the Washington Nationals, and a much-beloved member of the Ottawa Lynx and the Montreal Expos. I still remember when the Expos played a game here at the Rogers Centre. Somebody in right field, one of the right field hotel rooms, hung this big, huge sign that just said F.P. for P.M. And I'm sure FP managed to get a shot of that particular banner. The Washington Nationals, as I've said, I think we can probably call them the best team in baseball. They lost 3-2 to the Phillies last night after winning 9 of 10 at home. This is the first game of a 9-game road trip. They're 24-13 since the All-Star break, Joe. They have a 7.5-game lead over the Braves. They have the best strikeout-to-walk ratio in modern Major League Baseball history. In the past 11 weeks, they've led the majors in fielding percentage. They have also thrown out the highest percentage of base runners in the majors. And since the All-Star break, they've scored 169 runs, which is the best in baseball. This is a team that last year, coming off 2012, when they lost 3-2 to the Cardinals in that National League Division Series. Last year, finished 10 games over 500. Wasn't good enough to make the postseason in the National League. But boy, they've really rebounded with a vengeance this year.
Well, and this is a team that does it all. And You talk about pitching, hitting, defense, with every category you want to cover. This team is up near the top of the league, and that's how you win. But I'm anxious to talk to FP and ask him, what is it that makes them so special? Not just those things, but what it goes beyond that. How is it that you built that pitching rotation? How is it that you've developed this offense? So those are the things I'd like to hear.
And we've also got to point out, too, that it's not as if this has been smooth sailing for this team. They've had some pitching issues. Bryce Harper hasn't had the type of year a lot of people expect from Bryce Harper. There's been some indication that Matt Williams, their manager, and Bryce Harper haven't always been in the same page. Ryan Zimmerman was hurt. Still a lot of concern about what position he'll eventually take over. And if you're the Washington Nationals right now, if Ryan Zimmerman comes back, you're looking at trying to fit Zimmerman, Anthony Rendon, Denard Span, Bryce Harper, and Asdrubal Cabrera into the same lineup. I mean, you're almost in a position where you may wonder if you've got enough spots. You may not have enough spots for too many good players, and a lot of people think Ryan Zimmerman needs to be moved to the outfield. That's pretty much taken care of right now. But I'll tell you, if you're a major league manager, a major league team, you probably don't mind having that issue facing you right now. I think if you're Matt Williams, you would take trying to figure out how to get that extra body into your lineup on an everyday basis.
Nice problem to look forward to.
Absolutely. We don't have FP yet, so we'll continue our dialogue about around Major League Baseball as we wait for FP. A couple of newsy items. The Rangers are shutting down Yu Darvish for the season. They're also, I knew I was going to say, also shutting down Shin-Soo Choo. They're also shutting down Shin-Soo Choo with a bone spur in his left elbow. He's undergone season-ending surgery. And, Joe, if you're the Rangers right now, you're essentially saying, you're basically looking for any excuse to shut somebody down. And you might as well just line them up at Dr. Andrews' office and say, patient number one, followed by patient number two and patient number three.
What a season for the Texas Rangers when you look at, we talk about injuries throughout baseball, but I think Texas Rangers take the cake. They have just been decimated, and it's been going on all season long. And if you're the Rangers, yeah, the season cannot end soon enough. But why not just sit those guys out for the rest of the season? Get fresh. There's really nothing to play for this year. Get fresh and start anew in 2015.
Yeah, and they were a team that I think when they traded Ian Kinsler for Prince Fielder, I think a lot of people kind of wondered if maybe it wasn't an example of an organization maybe reacting to a lack of postseason success. The Rangers' window of opportunity has been open for a while, and they haven't stepped through it. And of course, we all know what happened when they did go to the World Series. And at the time, it seemed like a puzzling move to make.
It did, and I think it was pretty puzzling too to see that Prince Fielder leave Detroit also. So I think it kind of caught everybody off guard. I think things were caught off guard in the Motor City as well to think about Prince Fielder. And, he had his struggles certainly in the playoffs and all, but still a run producer each and every year. And when you take that out of your lineup, I think it was a little bit shocking in Detroit that he was gone. But by the same token, a player of the caliber of Ian Kinsler leaving Texas too, you just wonder what type of ramifications that has on a club.
The Chicago Cubs, by the way, are calling up another outfield prospect, Jorge Soler. And this is an organization that made one of the big deals well before the trade deadline with the Oakland Athletics. And they've taken kind of an interesting approach, Joe. They got Addison Russell's shortstop. They've taken kind of an interesting approach compared to a lot of other teams. I mean, all we hear in baseball is you got to build around pitching, which is true. But the Chicago Cubs have also gone about putting together what amounts to a starting minor league lineup of top 10 prospects at each position. And, and they'll tell you that it's kind of a counterintuitive thing. Yes, they realize that you need pitching. You certainly need pitching when you're at Wrigley Field. But they've essentially gone about just rebuilding their entire lineup. I mean, their lineup in 3 years could basically look like this year's Baseball America top 50 list for position prospects.
Well, they've certainly spent a lot of time stockpiling. And we talk about everything. It always starts with pitching. But, you can put together great pitching, too. But ultimately, you have to score some runs. So there is a happy medium there. But I think in the Cubs' case, you start with pitching, of course, but when you stockpile the prospects that they have, remember, not every prospect's going to hit either. So the more that you can build up right there, better chance that you've got of some of them panning out.
What do you think the Jays are going to do? We've talked about, they have Dalton Pompey. He appears to be their top position prospect. It's an organization that's got, I think anyhow, pretty good pitching depth. I think that in the minor league system, I think that's been shown this year. And again, you're right. Who knows what happens with prospects? They don't all, always hit a home run with them. But do you think this organization maybe shifts focus in the draft coming up? Next year's draft starts focusing on position players, or that maybe Alex this offseason looks at trying to add a guy who might be a core piece for the next 3 or 4 years as opposed to, going out and getting some guy who's 31 years old?
I think you still have to get the best player available at the particular time in the draft and build accordingly. But if you're pitching strong, that's a nice problem to have. And then if you have extra prospects, of course, that gives you those extra trade chips. And that's why I think it's important. You have to build from within. The draft is so important, whether it's pitching or position players. You have to gather the chips so that the ones that end up blossoming to the major leagues, they help you at the big league level. The ones that don't, you hope that those are your trade chips to help you acquire what the other needs are. But the most important thing is it has to start from within. You definitely can't do it through free agency or the waiver wire. It just does not work. So the most important thing is to draft the best player at the particular time.
See, this is one of the arguments I've been making. We're going to try to get FP on tomorrow. We haven't been able to reach him today. This is one of the arguments I've been making with when people start looking at Alex Anthopoulos and trying to judge what he's done is this is an organization that since I've been around here, Joe, has gone from, it's wanted to follow the Oakland Athletics, then it was kind of the Minnesota Twins, Tampa Bay's always been there. It's like it's an organization that's always been kind of searching for, I don't know, I don't want to say for a soul, but for an identity, a development identity. And one of the things Alex has done is he has compiled some pretty good young arms. And this, to me, I go back to when Alex took over as general manager. One of the things he made very clear, and one of the things, frankly, that was made clear to him by Paul Beeston in ownership is we need to have a core of young pitchers, that philosophically we need to have a core of young, homegrown, cost-effective pitchers and use that as the base around which you build the team. If you can get four-fifths or three-fifths of your starting rotation earning major league minimum, you know, you're in a position where you can start maybe spending some money in free agents or re-upping guys. And that's one of the things Alex has done. I mean, there are a lot of people who criticize Alex for the way this season's transpired, and there are things you can criticize him for. I firmly believe that. But I think in terms of where this system is now, or where this minor league system is now, there's a depth there that hasn't existed. I mean, I can remember, Joe, I can remember seasons where the Blue Jays literally did not have a pitching prospect that you would look at and go, yeah, this guy's capable of starting next year. I can remember years where the question was always, where do we get our pitchers from? And you're not seeing that now.
And I think that's, you're obviously seeing these kids coming up now and contributing at the major league level too, to see what Marcus Stroman has done this year. Of course, Drew Hutchison, who had already been here, but then what I really loved was the Aaron Sanchez call-up, because you're bringing a guy up, you're getting his feet wet in the major league level, but they're doing it in the bullpen. You can control his innings that way, but it is a nice way. As a young player, it's a lot to come up to the major leagues. It's a huge transition. You're learning an entirely new game because of the talent that you're facing, especially for a pitcher like Sanchez. And he found out last night, you're facing a Cespedes. Well, those kinds of hitters are not in AAA. To me, it's a waste of time being in AAA. Yeah. AAA is a nice jump from AA, because AA is still all those prospects. The pitchers have great arms. The hitters have power and speed. You get to AAA now, it's a nice transition because you're facing players that have some major league experience. But still, these are the guys that have had trouble sticking at the major league level. So when you make the jump up here, it's a whole new level. And what's been great is to see the Stroman, Hutchison, Sanchez is up here this year getting this experience. And I call it gaining valuable experience, because the experiences right now that they're getting are going to help them into the future as major league players. And then when you look at Anthony Gose, Ryan Goins, these are the type of, quote, future that you're building on. You just really hope the timing, the window is getting smaller here the next couple of years with the Bautistas around, and you know, Melky, this being his last year, who knows what's going to happen with him, but with the Reyes, and you hope that the timing is still there when these pitchers come to fruition. Are these bats still going to be hanging around?
And I remember talking to Pat Henkin one time about this whole idea about how, and Pat would always talk about, hey, when I came up, the idea was you came up, you got your feet wet in the bullpen, then you went into the rotation. And I tried to get him to say, okay, what exactly does that mean? That sounds very cliche-ish. And he said, you know what it is, basically? He said, you figure out, in the bullpen, you have a lot of time to sit and observe. You have a lot of time to absorb what other people are doing to get ready. And he said, what it's all about as a rookie, as a young guy, is figuring out, what do I have to do to be ready for whatever role I have, whether it's a starting pitcher or whether it's a reliever. What do I have to do to be ready in that given day? And he said, you know, it's foolish to think that a young pitcher, even if he's going to be a starter next year, isn't going to pick something up in the bullpen that's going to make him think, you know, that's kind of interesting. Maybe I'll try to incorporate that. And my sense from talking to Aaron Sanchez is he's doing that. He's figuring out a few things, and he's figuring out some things about himself as well.
You have to be a sponge, and much like Stroman and Hutchison, I hope, are doing in the dugout in the days that they're pitching, they're not pitching, hang around Mark Burley, talk about the hitters, how you're attacking them. That's how you learn and get better.
That is it for Baseball Central today. FP Santangelo, we will attempt to track him down tomorrow. It's FPI. There's probably a good reason he wasn't.
Probably out for a run.
Yeah, we'll say that. He's out for a run. For Joe Siddle, and for Aaron Fitt of Baseball America, he's been out for a run. That's our story. We're going to stick with it. I'm Jeff Blair saying thanks so much for joining us in Baseball Central. Jays Red Sox, game two tonight. Joe Siddle, Jerry Howarth, Mike Wilner have the call of it for you. We'll have it on the tube as well. Have a great day, everybody.